And we're back on the public diplomat, Guy and Guy, back in the house. Guy, how's it going?
Going well, as usual.
All right, good, good. Let's do some introductions for the audience because we never done this, right? So my name is Guy Golan, and I'm a professor at Texas Christian University. I teach social media, public relations, and advertising. For the last 20 years, I've been doing research on public opinion and journalism and media and really looking at public diplomacy and how governments try to shape and influence and build relationships with foreign publics. So that's my area of expertise. And, you know, am I an expert? It depends on who you ask and it depends on the day. Guy, what are you an expert in?
So I'm an expert in early American history, colonial and revolutionary history. I'm a professor at the University of North Texas. And my field was originally military history. That's how I got into this field, but I've expanded to the American Revolution or early America in general.
Okay, very good. And you wrote a book about pirates.
Yeah, so that's part. So again, my first book was about early American military history. And then my second book was taking it basically the same idea to see what I thought would be the same idea turned out to be a completely different book. And then my third book is about the American Revolution. But the piracy book is still about British America.
Okay, good stuff. So you just came back from an academic conference in France, if I'm correct. Can you tell us about this conference and what it was all about?
Yeah, so it was about this problem or this phenomenon of when historians disagree with contemporaries, meaning when historians disagree with the people that they study. Okay, so for example, me reaching certain conclusions about the American Revolution that are different than the beliefs, sentiments of people who lived through the American Revolution. And the—
Give me examples.
So the problem there that this raises is the students rightly ask, why should I believe you when the people who were there tell us something completely different? For example, historians overwhelmingly today believe that the people who fought the revolution, who led the revolution, represented a small radical fringe in colonial America. Whereas people who fought the revolution believe that they were the mainstream majority of American society. Another conflict between us historians and the contemporaries is that is over who won the war. We historians, military historians, believe that the Continental Army, the National Army, won the American Revolution, Revolutionary War. Whereas they, back in the day, they believed that their local militias were responsible for the victory.
So the tension really here in this debate is who is more of an expert, the expert with their process, right? Or
right.
The people who are being studied, investigated, analyzed. So let's give a more day-to-day example of this. You know, my grandmother used to always go to doctors. She was, you know, in her 80s, and every other week she would go to a different doctor, and she would say, "Doctor, I am sick." And every single doctor told her, checked her, and told her, "Lady, you're absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with you." And her answer was, "You don't know what you're talking about." And she would go to the next doctor, right? The doctor, and she went from doctor to doctor until she found one who said, "Lady, you're right. You're absolutely sick. And I'm glad you came here." Is this the kind of conversation we're having? The conversation between the expertise or the method of the doctor who diagnoses the patient or what the patient feels?
Now, first, regarding your grandmother, there's this cartoon of a gravestone in which, and it says, "Here lies blah, blah, blah." And then underneath it says, "I told you I was sick."
Probably my grandma.
Yeah. But look, this is exactly it. The doctor and the patient is a perfect example because there's no doubt that the doctor knows a lot about your body that you don't know. But at the same point, by the same token, you know things about your body that the doctor cannot know, regardless of all the tests and everything else. So the doctor cannot know what to measure and what to screen for if you don't tell him what symptoms you're experiencing through your nervous system. Another great example is your relationship with your, the method of the psychiatrist. Okay? So your therapist can listen to you when you come to complain about your, to say that your marriage is unsatisfying. If the psychiatrist asks you why, you might tell him, well, my wife isn't very supportive and whatever, so, you know, the sex life. And then the psychiatrist can follow one of two methods. He can follow your lead. You're the expert. You, the patient, are the expert. Let's deal with this thing with your wife and try to solve this problem, either making an adjustment in you or in her. Or the therapist can say, you think that this is an issue with your wife. In fact, it's an issue with your self-esteem, or it's an issue with your father, an unresolved issue with your mother, whatever it is. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it pits the expertise of the expert versus the expertise of the eyewitness, of the eyewitness here.
Okay, this is really interesting to me. You know, we study in my field, we study media and how news media and experts in the news media write the news and interpret the news. Last time we spoke a little bit about framing in our last episode about Ukraine. So I often think about how journalists collect information. I mean, we have the, you know, the editorial process, the journalistic process, right? Journalists don't just sit down, hear one side of the story and write a, you know, story. I mean, at least they're not supposed to, right? So, I mean, we have fact checking, we have verification, multiple data points, multiple points of view. You know, that's how you get to the truth. But so often, especially when it comes to politics here in the United States and coverage of foreign elections, I see this a lot. What we see is a really interesting dynamic that relates exactly to what you're talking about. The tension between the process of the expert, in this case, the journalist, and what the people that they're covering have to say. I'm reminded of the recent gubernatorial elections in Virginia when Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, won the elections. And if you were to follow the exit polls from Virginia that night, you saw that the main issues that voters turned out and, you know, the most important issue for them when casting their vote were Vietnamics, right? Taxation and the state of the economy, et cetera, right? And yet on many news channels, right, especially on CNN and MSNBC, experts came in and when they gave their interpretation of why Glenn Youngkin won this election, right? I mean, he unseated a sitting Democratic governor. They came out with a completely different interpretation. Their interpretation was that the Republicans used racial fear and that the voters were fooled or were driven to vote based on racial discrimination, fear, etc. Now, this is a perfect example.
It reminds me of the Brexit explanations as well. The voters said that they did it for this, and the experts said that it was false. Yeah. False. That the voters didn't understand why they did what they did.
Exactly. And when Trump beat Hillary, and of course, this is not just on the Democrat side. Republicans do it every single day. Fox News, you know, right-wing media, you know, they are guilty of the same bias or the same interpretation, or rather, and this is what we're talking about, they're not guilty of anything. They just trust their process, right?
Right.
Over exit polls, right? So they say, look, exit polls are great, but they provide a singular data point. And in journalism, we don't interpret reality based on a single data point, as you should not, right? But rather, we're taking multiple data points, multiple interpretations of things that are much more on the macro level,
right?
And we're putting them together. So I do want to point to the fact that oftentimes journalists will make, and this is the counterpoint to the man on the street perspective. The man on the street does not always have all the facts. He or she cannot always connect the dots in the same manner that an expert will. What do you think about that guy?
Yeah, so like in history, it's the same. Look, the method or the perspective of the historian is similar to that of the journalist in the sense that you observe a society. Okay, and there's no doubt that the historian knows more than the historical actors. Okay, more than the people who were there and experienced the Revolutionary War or the Vietnam War or whatever. The historian knows more because the historian has the benefit of hindsight and he has a lot more data and he sees things like the historical actor, the contemporaries, can see only what's in their field of vision, whereas the historian can see things beyond that, again, because of hindsight and integrated data. So the historian knows more, just like the doctor knows more and everything, like we talked. But the expert has to keep in mind, or the journalist, that hindsight has its own dangers. Because if you know the ending of the story, it means that you now are encouraged to read history backwards. Okay? And so now, because you know the end of the story, you will identify all sorts of small and trivial things. You'll be encouraged to identify various small and trivial things as important antecedents and early phases of that ending that you know is coming. Okay, so you'll connect the dots. For example, for the revolution, you'll connect something that happened in 1702 to the revolution of 1776, and you'll build a whole narrative about how, look, the revolution was a long time coming. It's a long process. And when you see data that contradicts it, you'll legitimately, or you'll dismiss it as anecdotal because it doesn't fit. Look at the pattern of dots that I've connected. So my point is that when you have a lot of data points, you're able to, again, not because you're lying, but you really do see, you can see a variety of patterns in this mass of data points, which means that you're much more vulnerable to confirmation bias than when you had only a few data points.
So, I mean, really here, we score one for the common man or score one for the experts. We're still doing the math here, right? What we're discussing really is a challenge that everybody who's a social scientist incurs every single day, right? Do we really take the observations and connect them in a way that is not confirming our own point of view? I mean, and if we're doing that, we're not social scientists, we're just activists, right? So this is a really, really important conversation to have.
Well, I'd say that we are social scientists in the sense that social scientists, like all scientists, are prone to confirmation bias. That's what philosophers of science tell us all the time. But look, I want to clarify that I'm assuming you're not either, but I'm not arguing in favor of less knowledge, of having, let's not complicate our lives with having more data. I'm just saying that we, because we're data people, we have this belief that, oh, if we only had more data, we'd be able to solve the problem, reach the truth or whatever. And we need to think about the fact that having a wealth of information, for me, about the past has pros, but it also has cons. Okay? It makes historical research easier in some respect, but it also creates problems because you have to analyze all this data. You have to have some sort of formula to organize this data. Okay? So the method you pick will determine the outcome. And most of us pick a method that makes sense to us in the sense that it confirms or that it works well with the framework that we already have based on graduate school. So, and like I said, it's true for historians, it's true for medical experts, epidemiological experts, mathematicians, and anyone who handles data has to decide what to measure, how to measure it, and then create some sort of sorting method for all this data that'll tell you how much weight to give each piece of data, you know?
Exactly, and we have to be afraid, be careful not to bring our own biases or personal worldviews into it. Yeah. It reminds me of the old saying by Benjamin Disraeli, I think he said that there are three types of lies in the world, small lies, big lies, and statistics. It also reminds me of a conversation we had about law and order, right? The criminal justice system.
Yeah. So the kind of debates that we have about, like what you mentioned about who gets elected governor or president, they're important because we follow politics, but this, and it highlights this problem of the expert versus the people. But it's not a real constant. If Trump is president or Biden is president, it makes a difference in your life, but marginal, okay? But this conflict between the expert and the eyewitness has much more consequential impacts that make it a really important thing rather than a theoretical thing for historians and scientists to think about. Like, for example, whether you go to prison or not. Okay? So a few years ago, there was a case in Texas in which four women sat in prison for 16 years for sexual abuse of I think in kindergarten or something, that never happened because forensic scientists convinced the jury to convince. Okay? And again, they weren't lying. They were just wrong. Okay? So just like, you know, criminal investigators don't trust eyewitness testimony. Okay? They think that the eyewitnesses are prone to confusion, panic, bad memory, et cetera, et cetera. They trust forensic data. Okay? By contrast, juries really do trust, you know, so because juries are non-experts, they really do trust eyewitness testimony. And so a conflict between investigators and juries or investigators and people. And in cases like this, like this Texas case, it reminds us that yes, eyewitness testimony has its credibility problems or reliability problems, but so does expert testimony. Okay, and so no matter how many times experience proves that the previous generation of experts were wrong, you know, that the scientific standards were flawed or whatever else, the new batch of experts never develop a sense of humility about expertise. Okay, so the, you know, having more data, having better science, really, it solves the ignorance problem. Okay, so now we know more than we did before, but it doesn't necessarily produce greater understanding. Having more data doesn't produce necessarily greater understanding. It could produce greater confusion too. Okay?
It could, and you know, you're pointing to something that everybody knows, but few of us really say. Whenever you have the word PhD after your name, you're supposed to know a lot about a lot of different things, and most PhDs don't know anything about many things, right? So, something for all of us to keep in mind and keep you humility is a good thing. I want to bring it back to geopolitics, which is, you know, it's my bread and butter, and this is what I really care about. I think this conversation is super interesting and relevant. When you think about coverage of foreign wars and foreign affairs, I mean, right now we have the war in Ukraine, but before that it was Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, you know, with different events happening over there. I remember when the Arab Spring began back in the day, how Western experts, think tank experts, op-ed columnists completely misunderstood what was happening on the streets of the Middle East, right? And they try to provide a Western democratic worldview interpretation into the rebellion against the government in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia and all around the Middle East, right? So again, let's bring back the same conversation that you all had as historians, but same as the doctor who looked at my grandmother, same as the criminal justice system or the psychologist with his patient or her patient, right? And that is, when there is an international event, who should we trust? Should we trust the people on the street, the people who march in the Arab Springs or in Black Lives Matters or in any social movement around the world? Or should we trust the person sitting in the think tank, right? Who says, you know what? It's true that they're more connected to reality right now, but they lack the scientific process. And they lack the big picture. They cannot connect the dots. And we can because we're local experts. And
yeah. This whole conversation is about two methods, two experts, okay? Is is the person himself, you know, the person at Tahrir Square or the person fighting the American Revolution, is he the expert about himself, or is the expert the expert about that person? So are people, the question is whether people are credible witnesses about their own lives, their own society, and everything else. And in this case, I hope it shouldn't be a, do we trust this guy or this guy? We understand why the person thinks that he understands himself. That's the problem with the experts, is not that they think they're experts, but in fact they're not. The problem with experts is that they're not humble. Okay? They don't acknowledge that there's a limit to what they can know. Okay? So like whenever some analyst like this comes on TV, he never says, well, nobody knows the future. Okay, or you know, there's only, I don't know. Have you ever heard an expert say on
they're not going to be invited back to the studio,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. So it's true of scientists and social scientists and of journalists, but, and this is what I want to ask you, we understand why scientists and medical doctors and even social scientists have this lack of humility, okay? Because they're experts, okay? And so this expertise creates an abundance of confidence in my expertise, so fine, in my knowledge. So again, I can mount a defense of the doctor and the psychologist and the social scientist, et cetera, and the historian. But journalists don't have this defense for their lack of humility because the journalists are not even experts. Okay, like the sociologist is an expert in sociology. So we can say to stick to your lane, okay? But at least he's an expert in this one thing. Journalists aren't experts in anything. Yeah, they have a thin layer of knowledge on a variety of things. They're not experts at anything. And so their lack of humility is really indefensible.
Well, I do want to point to something that is kind of unique to the American media landscape. We see this more and more in other nations, but I've seen other models as well. In the United States, what we refer to as news programming on television, especially on cable news television, is not really journalism. I mean, you know, the talking heads on Fox News and on MSNBC, oftentimes when there is a topic to be analyzed, you're not getting the deep area experts invited to the studio, but rather you're getting a Republican strategist or a Democratic strategist. They look like they're journalists because they're on a news program on television, but they're not journalists. Hmm. They're political hacks, right? As Jon Stewart famously told Tucker Carlson 20 years ago on Crossfire, right? And this is something to keep in mind. When people watch the evening cable news programs, they think they're watching journalism. They're not. They're watching political theater. So the people in the political theater are not deep experts. They're partisans.
Okay, but that's true of these debate shows and everything else on these news networks. But the same thing that we're talking about is true, like what you pointed out about the Virginia election was true of the New York Times and USA Today and Wall Street Journal. Like, these are not political debate shows. They really are news, traditional news. And they exhibit the same
kind of... We have seen something that's happening to the newsroom. Right, to the newsrooms of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. They're becoming more partisan, and the model of objective journalism is changing. I mean, you know, when American journalism started in the early days, it was clearly partisan. There was no hiding behind it. It changed for a few decades, right, in the 20th century, but now we're going back because readers want their newspapers to confirm their worldview. We have echo chambers and selective exposure, but these are deep conversations for another day. I think today was just really to highlight the people versus the experts or the experts versus the people. So Guy, who would you vote for between the experts and the people?
My method, and again, in my work, is the people in the sense that, look, again, there are two methods of history, you know, that one tries to channel the beliefs and the understanding of people at the time, and the other tries to identify forces and influences that they were not necessarily aware of, but I am aware of. So both methods, I think, are speculative, but at least, but to my mind, the first method is less speculative because, as a historian, and you know, to point to other fields of expertise, as a historian, I can tell you that experts on history can't even agree on what happened in the past, let alone why. Okay? And that's with the benefit of hindsight. Okay? And so, again, I try to keep in mind the humility that was projected to me in graduate school, that you don't know very much, and therefore just stick to your lane and say only what you really know, and we have better clues to really know what people at the time thought and believed than things that we think influenced them without their knowledge. So,
well, I'll tell you, you just challenged me in this podcast. I will try to stick to my lane and stick to my very, very limited area of knowledge and expertise. But Guy, thank you so much for sharing this very interesting conversation. I don't think we have these kind of conversations in academia often enough. So awesome. Thank you very much. And thank you to everybody who tuned in today. We would love to hear your opinion on this conflict. It's not really a conflict, but this stress between these two worldviews. Should we listen to the experts with their process or to the people on the ground? We'd love to hear your comments. Until next time, for the two guys, have an awesome day. Thank you so much for tuning in.